Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, you're running out of time. So do it now. Register for the Here We Still Stand event in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's October 15th and 16th. It's a two-day event, $65 for you to come. It includes your lunch at one of Scott Keith's favorite restaurants. You're not going to the restaurant. The restaurant's bringing the food to you, but it's one of his favorites. So if you want to know what Scott Keith likes to eat, you need to come to the conference. You're going to get some of that. It's included in your registration. All right, Chad. So last week we ended with David and Absalom, or their armies anyway, finally meeting head-to-head to try to resolve this conflict. David stayed behind. Absalom took the advice that was given to him by David's friend and went out into battle, got his hair tangled up in a great tree, and he did not survive that or the rage of Joab. And so Joab made him into a pincushion and buried him under a big pile of rocks. And that's where we ended. David doesn't know. Joab did not want to bring Absalom's body back with him. He figured that was probably not a good idea to let David see that. David might think that death looked a little excessive, especially since he had given the orders to go easy on him. And Joab did anything but that. And so that's where we're at. We're going to find out today David's response to hearing that Absalom was not gone easy on.
Yeah, it was sort of a cliffhanger because you're wondering, if you don't know the story, you're like, oh man, so how's David going to react to this? Probably not well. And as we shall see, you would be right. He does not act well to this, respond well to this. In fact, it is, in my opinion, the most, how to put it, not just emotional, but like heart-wrenching scene, if not the most, certainly one of the most heart-wrenching scenes that we have in Scripture. And it's given David and Absalom's history, I know they're father and son, but given kind of the frigid relationship they'd had and everything, of course, that has just happened with Absalom. I mean, he rebelled against his father, drove him out of the city, so on and so forth. Given all that background, it is a little surprising when we get to David's reaction that he just basically comes undone. But we'll talk about it when we get there. But in my mind, I'm thinking there's been some, I guess, change of heart on the part of David through this whole ordeal. And because of that, he is going to react with this emotional upheaval once he does learn of Absalom's death. I'm getting ahead of myself.
I think as we look at this chapter, David is going to, I think what you have, like this sort of mourning tells me that David deep down knows that this is pretty much his fault. Whether you go all the way back to the Bathsheba thing, certainly if you go back to the way that he responded or didn't respond to the rape of his daughter, the exile of Absalom, the return of Absalom, and then treating him like he wasn't his son. I find it very difficult to believe that deep down David doesn't believe or know even that if he had done things differently that none of this happens and his son isn't dead. However, I do think that David also is going to try to figure out how to take this out on someone else and put the blame on someone else, and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, there is this kind of weird vacillation with David where at one point you'll think, yeah, you know, he's finally come to full realization that David is to blame for all the things that David is experiencing. And then he'll turn around, as we'll see, and kind of shift the blame to somebody else. So it's like, which David are you dealing with in these chapters? But I can say this is kind of all giving you a taste of what is to come. We first of all have to deal with a couple of runners here, a couple of messengers, and we'll see how that works. The first of these is one that we've already met. He's the son of Zadok, Ahimaaz. And he is going to, so we're in 2 Samuel 18:19. He's going to step forward and say, you know what, let me be the one who carries the news from the battle to David. So he says to Joab, let me run and carry news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies. Now Joab says, no, let's not. You're not the guy for this. He says, you're not the one to carry the news today. I tell you what, some other day, you can be the guy, but not today, because the king's son is dead. Now, Joab has been around David a long time. And so Joab knows that in the past, David has not responded well when messengers brought news that he didn't want to hear. In fact, a couple times he had people killed when they brought news that he did not want to hear. And so who knows? Joab is well aware of the fact that David is not in a good place, and he actually might react violently when he receives this news. So the last guy that he wants to send is the son of Zadok to deliver this news. So he says, no, you're not the guy. But then he turns to another guy, another messenger, a runner, who is not named, but he's called the Cushite. Cushites were, sometimes it's translated as Ethiopian. They were from south of Egypt, land of Cush. So he's a runner. He's a messenger in this army. So Joab turns to him and says, you go tell the king what you've seen. So the Cushite does this formal bow and takes off. So these are our ancient marathoners, I suppose. So he takes off, but Ahimaaz is one of those guys who will not take no for an answer. He says to Joab, come what may, let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab's just more or less, why? Why do you, there's not going to be any reward for you, so why do you want to do this? But he will not take no for an answer, so finally he says, okay, go, run. So he takes off. And it turns out, reminds me of like the resurrection morning where John outruns Peter. So Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain. Now we're not sure. I mean, did he just choose a flatter path? Was it a shortcut he knew? Who knows? Anyway, he obviously knew a better way, and he ends up outrunning the Cushite. So we have a little foot race here going on between these two messengers. So they both know basically what happened. So they both have this same message to deliver. It's just a question of how are they going to deliver it. And as we'll see, Ahimaaz, for all his zeal to get there first, doesn't do a great job when he gets to David. So they're going to each have this message to deliver, and we'll see how David reacts.
Does it seem to you like maybe initially the thought is, well, you don't know that there's not a reward for this. Like, this might be news that David is really wanting to hear. I mean, is that the guy that took Jerusalem is dead. So and maybe he hasn't figured out that this is not news that David wants to hear, and we'll see, we're about to see it. But once he gets to David and reads his countenance, he realizes that this is not news that he wants to deliver at all. That's what it feels like to me.
I think it's what's going on. Yeah, he thinks that, man, yeah, David's gonna be happy. I mean, so I want to be the evangelist here. I want to be, and this, by the way, is the Hebrew behind this, is the Greek equivalent is to evangelize. This is to tell somebody news, right? So I'm going to carry the news. I'm going to basar in Hebrew. So this is great news. I mean, everything worked out. Absalom and his army were defeated. So I want to be the one who tells David this. And yeah, and when he gets there, and he reads David's countenance, his reaction, and when he hears what David asks him,
right,
he's probably thinking, no, I should have listened to Joab.
Yeah, that
should not have done this.
Yeah, this seems like he's like, I don't know, Joab. I think that David hates Absalom. Like, he banished him. He didn't talk to him. And then his son rose up. Like, I'm telling you, whoever gives David this news, I think there's a chance that he's going to be winning the favor of the king. I think it seems to me that he figures out real quick that this is not the case, and that Joab was correct when he was like, there's no reward. And if there is a reward, it ain't the kind of reward you want.
No, David has an infamous track record of giving unwanted rewards to messengers who bring bad news. So David, what's he doing? Well, we know that he did not go out with his armies, so they made him basically stay behind. So he's sitting between the two gates, we're told, in verse 24. So a lot of these ancient cities would have basically an inner wall and an outer wall. And of course, you have gates with each of these walls with, of course, space between them. So that's where David is at. He's between these two gates. And there's a watchman who's up on the roof of the gate by the wall. Kind of an irony here, by the way, because, of course, this whole ordeal that we've been tracing for these last few chapters began where? On a roof. David was on his own roof when he looked down and saw Bathsheba bathing. And, you know, you can trace it all back to that particular rooftop event. Well, now there's a watchman up there. He's on the roof and he's looking on the horizon and he sees a man running alone. So he calls out to the king, bends over the wall and hollers down to David. He says, you know, somebody's coming. And the king says, well, if he's alone, there's news in his mouth. In other words, you know, if this was probably, he means good news. So if there's a whole group of them, presumably they're retreating and things did not go well. So if there's just one guy, that's a good sign. So he goes nearer and nearer. And then the watchman says, look, there's another guy. So he calls down and says, I see another man running alone. And David says he also brings news. I'm thinking David is probably thinking, hoping that everything is going to work out well.
Yeah, man, this is some positive vibes only kind of stuff.
This is positive vibes only. Yeah, he's thinking, yeah, this has got to be, it's going to be good. It's going to be good. Just keep repeating that as often as you want to, David.
Yeah, because he's like, they'd be retreating if they got wiped out. And you're like, oh, or they got wiped out and there's only one guy coming back. maybe it's way worse than you think.
Maybe it is way worse. Yeah. And then the watchman, all these details are kind of fascinating because we don't often get, I mean, intricate details like this. But the watchman, he's like, you know what? I think the running of the first guy is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. So evidently, he knows how the guy runs. He's like, oh, you know what? That guy looks like Usain Bolt.
Yeah, a unique stride on this guy.
You got a unique stride on him, which I guess, you know, if you pay attention to people's running, you can tell the difference between them. Anyway, he says, I think that's who it is. And of course, he was right. The king said, oh, he's a good man. He comes with good news. This is more of these positive.
Yeah, David's really trying. Oh, yeah. He's really trying to talk himself into this.
Yes, he is. So, well, then, okay, so Ahimaaz, faster runner or took the shortcut. He gets there. And first words out of his mouth, in English, it's three, all is well. In Hebrew, it's just one word. As you might suspect, it's shalom. And probably out of breath, I'm assuming. But he's managed to get out shalom. He bows before the king with his face to the earth. And here's the message. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. That's, you know, it's true. It's very formal. It's very true. It's not extremely detailed, of course. He doesn't tell how everything happened. He doesn't name any individuals. He just said the men who raised their hand against my lord have been defeated.
Yeah, so he's
he includes God here.
Yeah, so he's just conveying to David that we won.
Yeah, we won, basically. Yeah, we were victorious. God gave us the victory. Now, here's how David responds. And the response is even better in Hebrew because there's sort of a play on words. So in the ESV, it says, the king says, is it well with the young man Absalom? Now, almost every word here is significant. Notice even what he calls him. He does it. He uses na'ar in Hebrew, which, you know, it kind of has a, it's got a positive feel to it. You know, it's not something you're going to call your enemy, in other words. It's not a term of endearment, but, you know, it was something that you would speak. It's a word you would use positively when describing someone. It's not a word you're going to use to describe someone who just staged a coup and took your kingdom away. But the play on words here is that when it says, is it well, he's asking, is it shalom? So is it shalom with the young man of shalom? So Absalom is a play, is combining two words, of and then shalom. So is it shalom with of shalom? Now at this point, Ahimaaz is probably realizing what we talked about a minute ago, that this was not the kind of news that David wanted to hear.
Think about this. David doesn't ask, how many men did I lose? Was it a solid victory? Was it close? I mean, what's the body count? I mean, these are all questions that someone would want to know. If they have no idea how it went, like, you might want to know how much of your army you have left. You know, was this like a complete rout? Was it, you know, the general's dead? There's all kinds of things you could be asking, but he asked none of those things. All he wants to know is is my son well? Yeah, and I'm guessing the way that he asks does not lead him to believe that he's wanting to find out that he's dead. He's not saying, he doesn't say, is, you know, did they kill, you know, did they kill the traitor Absalom? He's saying, is it well with the young man Absalom? And I no doubt at this point, this guy's like, I gotta start listening to Joab. Joab knows this guy better than I do.
Yes, he does. So let me read you Ahimaaz's response from the ESV, and then I'm going to read you another translation by Robert Alter, and I'll tell you what he says about the Hebrew here. So Ahimaaz, he says, this is the ESV, when Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I don't know what it was. Now, he knows what it was. He's trying to evade exactly what happened. So that's the ESV.
This sounds like you're stammering. Like, even like, in the, like, I don't know. I don't read the Hebrew like you, Chad, in the same way. But in English, this sounds like when Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, but I saw a great commotion, but I don't know what it was. I don't even know what that means. Like that's.
You've hit on it. You've hit on it. In fact, so let me read you this nonsense translation by Robert Alter. I mean, it's a great translation, but it's nonsense. What Ahimaaz is saying. I saw a great crowd to send the king's servant Joab and your servant, and I know not what. ... So, and this is Robert Alter's comment on that. He says, this is nearly gibberish.
Yes.
this is nearly gibberish, but not because of any corruption of the Hebrew text. Ahimaaz has been posed a question he does not dare answer. So he begins to talk nervously and incoherently.
Yeah, that's how. And it reads that way in English. You're like, this guy is just tripping all over his words. Like, doesn't want.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I saw a commotion. I don't know what I was. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So it's sort of a. I mean, it's a serious situation, but it's kind of a humorous occasion where the Bible accurately records gibberish, like you say, somebody's tripping all over the words. So at this point, David realizes he's not going to get a clear answer out of him. So he just says, basically, stand over there. Turn aside, stand over there. So he does. He's like, phew, close call. Gets out of the way. And the Cushite gets there. And the Cushite says, he's pretty straightforward. He doesn't even stop to bow. He just says, good news for my lord the king. For the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rose up against you. So he's basically saying the same thing that Ahimaaz said. And now the king's going to ask him almost verbatim the exact same question. Is it shalom with the young man Absalom? Is it well with the young man Absalom? The Cushite, either he's not really paying attention or he doesn't know David well, or he's just a lot bolder because he is straightforward. He says, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. Well, you don't need an interpreter to tell you what the Cushite is implying by that. So in other words, you know what? Anybody who rises up against you for evil, they need to end up like that guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to say he's dead. He doesn't need to say how he's dead. David gets a point.
This is a little ominous too, right? If you don't have the details, like, hey, like, you know, what happened to Absalom, and the response is simply, "Would that all your enemies end up how he ended up?" That sounds bad.
That sounds very bad.
Like that, yeah. that makes you believe that, like, oh well, you know, there was the great battle, and we found him, you know, he was slain in battle. It sounds worse than that to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like it'd be drawn and quartered, basically, the way that he portrays it. Well, the Cushite is not killed, thankfully, even though David is not always reacting positively to news like this. Instead, we're told, and this is this emotional scene that I alluded to earlier. Verse 33 says, the king was deeply moved. The Hebrew there is ragaz, which is often used. Actually, it's used for describing earthquakes, the shaking of something, or if someone is shaking with rage. So it's always kind of this trembling. Actually, deeply moved is probably the best translation, because of course we know deeply moved is a metaphorical description of this emotional state, but look at the verb moved. So it has this idea of their, you know, actual trembling. He was deeply moved, went up to his chamber over the gate and wept. And I'll just read the next few words. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." And he's going to repeat, we'll see this in a few more verses in chapter 19. There's a total of, between this verse and then 19 verse 4, there's a total of 8 times when David cries out, "Bani, Bani, Bani, my son, my son, my son, Absalom." And you can you can just feel the emotion. You don't have to, to be there. You don't have to read it in the original language. All you got to do is just listen to those words, and you can tell what's going on with David. We've never seen him in a state like this before. And I mean, despite all the things, and we've seen him react to people's deaths before. We've seen him react angrily. We've seen him act with lamentation. We've seen him react with, you know, political motives. But we've never seen him so low, so deeply moved by anything that's happened to him up to this point, as he is now by the death of Absalom.
Well, see, we have an example of a son dying, and you know, when his child was born with Bathsheba, and he is praying, and he is fasting, and he is crying out to God for, as the son is ill, and then the moment his son dies, he cleans up and gets on with it, and mm-hmm. he says, "I'll see him again." Essentially, like he's not going to come back to me, but the day is coming when I will go to him. This is not how this works with Absalom, and it's interesting that he's, you know, he says, "Oh, that I would have died instead of you," and you're like, "Well, first of all, that could have been arranged."
That could very well easily have happened. Yeah.
But also, the reason your son's dead is not because you refuse to die, but I think your son's dead because you refuse to die to yourself. Mm-hmm. You refuse to die to your pride. You refuse to die to your anger. Mm-hmm. All of those things. Like it was the death to self that resulted in the death of Absalom. Like David didn't need to physically die to keep Absalom alive. He just needed to die to his ego and pride and all this other stuff.
Yeah, and that's an important part of forgiving others. To forgive anyone else almost always requires that kind of self-death.
Yep.
We have to give up. We have to die to all those things that you described. And before all this happened, David simply refused to do that. So we see now all of this kind of coming to him, and he realizes, you know, too late, of course. As often happens with us, you know, it's in the aftermath of something we're like, you know, if I'd have done A and B and C, then all these other things wouldn't have happened. And, you know, there's something good in that. There's some good in looking back on our mistakes, because hopefully we'll learn in the future not to do those same things. But when it's something like this, you know, which leads to the death of a son, then, you know, there's certain things that can't be changed. You can't go back and undo all of these things. And I suppose that's why it hits David as hard as it does.
Yeah, this is a really hard way to learn that there's not any weakness in forgiveness.
Yeah. It's you know, as hard as it is to forgive people, it's even harder when you don't, because the repercussions from that are always worse. You know, better a little death to self and the peace that comes from that in forgiving others than refuse to forgive and to continue kind of having that death live on inside you and, you know, just growing more and more bitter as time goes on. So that's the end of chapter 18. It's a unforgettable scene. Now, chapter 19, Joab again. We were talking before we started recording about Joab, what a fascinating character he is. And an underrated character. He's someone who deserves a lot more of our attention. And of course, if you're listening to the podcast, you realize that, because he's been and a pivotal player in all of these chapters.
Chad may or may not have promised to write a book about him.
Yeah, I may or may not have. Well, I'm almost finished. I'm like two chapters away from finishing the book on Jacob that I'm writing that'll be out next year. So I got to decide what I'm going to do next. So I'm not promising it's going to be Joab, but he is on my list. Let's put it that way. So Joab, man, this is what he's about to say to David is probably, I think it's certainly in the Bible itself, one of the sharpest rebukes that anyone ever gives to a leader to his face.
Joab is not in a position any longer where he really fears David. It seems at this point, Joab's probably older at this point as well, but Joab's seen enough now that all the David shine has worn off. He's not enamored with who David is or anything like that. And at this point, just doesn't have any fear of him, and you can tell because he's willing to say things to him. He doesn't have to muster up a bunch of courage to do it. It doesn't seem like it seems like he can just go up to David and tell him exactly what he thinks. And if that goes badly for him, it seems that he doesn't really care anymore.
Yeah, there's no like parabolic trick up his sleeve. He doesn't go and get the wise woman from Tekoa and says, mm-hmm. Hey, I need you to go tell the king a story and maybe he'll, you know, speak words that indict himself. No, he just marches in and has a come to meeting Jesus with David.
I mean, it seems that Joab is no doubt angry about this entire thing. Joab cannot be happy with how this went out. I mean, Joab, I'm sure he's angry with Absalom. He's angry with David. He just had a bunch of guys that he is a commander of get killed over this whole thing. And he's probably irritated with this family. Because Joab was trying to keep this exact sort of thing from happening, and Absalom didn't do the things that Joab wanted him to do. David didn't do the things that he wanted him to do. Joab, I think, knows exactly where to place the blame for this. I mean, I would imagine that when Joab killed Absalom, he's extremely angry with Absalom, but that it's not because he has this ferocious loyalty to David. I think he's angry with David, too. I think he's angry with both of them and knew that Absalom had to be taken out and that David, now in this state of all this emotion and falling apart, like, just seems like Joab's like, look, man, I can't deal with all the mess that you guys have created. Now you're acting this way. I had to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... If you put yourself in Joab's spot, I think you can understand how frustrated he is. And like I said, as a commander, I'm sure he's thinking about, I just had a bunch of guys that had to die because you guys had too much, because of pride and ego. And I had, like, now I got a bunch of dead soldiers and the kingdom's like all split up now. And like, we're gonna have to work to get everyone back together. And I'm sure he's a very frustrated man.
It's one of these, if you would only listen to me, kind of situations. So 19 begins, it was told Joab. So remember, they sent the runner ahead. So Joab presumably is still coming in from the field of combat. So he's told, look, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So, and this is not the report, this is the way it's described by the narrator here. So the victory that day was turned into mourning. So we go from salvation into weeping for all the people. For the people heard that day, so the news is spreading, you know, through the army and even the civilians, that the king is grieving for his son. Now you're a soldier, or you're maybe the father or mother of a soldier, or the sister of a soldier, and you're thinking, wait, what? All this happened because of the king's son, and now the king is grieving this son? So what do the people do? It says the people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. So this, by the way, literarily is kind of an envelope structure, kind of a beginning and end structure, because how did this all start? Not not like all the way back with David and Bathsheba. I mean, the deal with Absalom started when he would stand at the gate of the city and talk to the people who were coming into the city. And basically, you know, he would be a kind of a populist contender and tell them, oh, you know, everything would be better if I was in charge. And we're told that he stole the hearts of the men of Israel by doing that. Now, the same verb is used here, same Hebrew verb is used here for how the people stole into the city, as people steal who are ashamed when they flee in battle. So David's reaction is basically covering everybody with shame because of what's going down. Well, the king, verse 4, covers his face, and he cries with a loud voice, and this is a repetition of what we saw earlier. Oh, my son Absalom. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. So everybody knows what the king is doing. Everybody knows the king's reaction, and it's having a national impact upon the Israelites. So Joab gets to the city, marches into the house of the king, and I'll just read his entire speech. It's verse 5 through 7. You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines, because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you. For you've made it clear today that commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today, I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now, therefore, get up, go out, and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord. Oh, this is not much of a veiled threat here. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. That's a speech. That is so Nathan's speech to David pales in comparison to this. This is he out-prophets the prophet here. He's very clear that, listen, this is what your behavior has caused. And this is the message that you are clearly sending, the message you're clearly sending. And of course, there's some exaggeration in theirs, but he's exaggerating to make this point. The exaggeration is, look, it's pretty obvious to all of us, not just me, but everybody else, that if Absalom was alive and all of us were slain on the battlefield, you'd be happy. Yeah. He's like the only person you care about.
Yeah, there would not be all this weeping and mourning going on if all your commanders were dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd be happy only because Absalom was alive. And notice one, two, three, four, five times in that speech, we have the word today. Once it's translated this day, but in Hebrew, they're all the same, hayom. So today you've covered with shame the faces of these. Today saved your life. And you've made it clear today that today, if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, you'd be happy. So over and over, he uses this word hayom, today, 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 to emphasize the fact that the threat that David is now under is imminent. Things are, your whole kingship is coming unraveled today. So you don't have the ability to think back to yesterday and maybe, you know, relive all those events that have led to what's going on today. That can't happen because today is what matters. If you don't do something today, then there will be no tomorrow for you. Your future is ruined if you don't act, if you don't do what I say, basically. And then there is that threat. If you don't go out, not a man will stay with you this night, meaning also, of course, me either. I think this is Joab's way of saying, unless you do exactly what I say, get up, clean up, get out there and encourage your troops, I'm going to take over.
Yeah,
and I'll do a lot better job than you are.
Yeah, I think Joab is letting him know, because when David ran, he didn't run, at least we're not told that this, it sure doesn't seem like this, like he didn't run with some huge army. This army was assembled because his friend bought him time. Mm-hmm. It seems that what Joab is threatening is, you got to pull yourself together. You don't have time for whatever it is that you're doing right now. You got to pull yourself together right now. And if you don't, We're going to find out who ultimately these armies are loyal to.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's it. Yeah. Unless you do what I say, then any good that we might be able to pull out of this, any cohesion we might be able to recapture is not going to happen.
I mean, basically, Joab is going to go out there and he's going to say, look at the king right now. You know, we just fought this battle and saved his life and saved the lives of all his family. Look at how he's responding. I'm out. Who's with me? And this Joab is pretty convinced that this is going to be compelling. And everyone's like, yeah, I'm not going to stay with this guy. He doesn't appreciate what we did. He doesn't, like, there was no acknowledgement for how many people, how many lives it cost. It seems that Joab feels pretty confident that this is going to be a pitch that works, and that David will have a real problem on his hands when he has Joab rise up with his army and David has no one.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we'll see, David does. I mean, he's going to respond positively. He's going to do what Joab says. But you can tell by his actions subsequent to this that either because he was threatened by Joab or just doesn't like him or all that bad blood they had between them, that he may have done what Joab said, but he didn't like it because he doesn't like him. He doesn't trust him. But he does. See, verse 8 says the king got up. He took his seat in the gate. Presumably, this was like sort of an official move. He's back where he should be when the army is victorious. And all the people were told. So earlier, all the people were told the king is grieving for his son. That was back in verse 2. Now all the people are told, oh, look, the king is sitting in the gate. That is, the king has now assumed his official position, the kind of position that he would assume when his soldiers are victorious. And all the people came before the king so that he could probably speak words of encouragement to them. So all the people are doing that. Now we're told that Israel had fled every man to his own home. We're going to pick this up later on. So the people that stay loyal to David, they're coming to him. Everybody else is trying to figure out what to do. So everybody's gone home. The people are arguing through all the tribes, verse 9, saying, okay, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies. David did. He saved us from the Philistines. And now he's fled out of the land from Absalom. They're trying to figure this out. They go, but Absalom, the guy that we anointed over us, well, he's dead in battle. So why, what are we going to do? Why do you say nothing about bringing the king back? So the people are, this is kind of a summary of the kind of conversations that are going on. And you can see how the people are, they're trying to figure out what's next, right? So we had David. Okay, then we had Absalom, but Absalom is dead, so why don't we bring the king back? And then David begins to be active too. He sends a message to Zadok and Abiathar, who were the priests, and he says to them to tell the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his house when all Israel has come to the king? You're my brothers, you're bone of my bone, you're flesh of my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? So David is beginning at least to once more act in a way that's trying to bring a little cohesion. So he's trying to bring back the members of his own tribe, some of whom had turned against him. He's trying to get them to initiate the welcome of him back. And then this is an amazing move on David's part. Verse 13 says, and so this is the continuation of his message. And say to Amasa. Now you got to remember who Amasa is. Amasa was, he's a relative of David, and he's the one that Absalom placed over his army. So that's who we're talking about here. So this is the Joab equivalent of Absalom's army. Say to Amasa, David tells them, aren't you my bone and my flesh? Aren't you my relative? God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of my army from now on in place of Joab. So that is the indication that David, either because of the bold rebuke that Joab gave him or because of that and everything else, is done with Joab. He realizes that he's dealing with a man who could easily pull an Absalom. Joab could easily pull an Absalom and basically stage his own coup. He could take over and probably not have any issues whatsoever. And so he's going to try and replace Joab, or he says he's going to replace Joab, with Amasa. And then, to kind of wrap everything up, verse 14 says that he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah. And we're not sure if the he here is David or Amasa. I'm thinking it's probably Amasa. Amasa swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, so they sent word to the king, return, both you and all your servants. And so the king begins his journey back. He comes to the Jordan. Judah comes to meet the king and to bring him over the Jordan. And with the stop there, because we're out of time, but kind of that's the situation that we're in. So David is beginning his return to Jerusalem. His exile is over. He's coming back, but he's got to deal with some issues that are kind of lingering from the past, which we'll get into in the next episode. He's gonna face Shimei again, the guy that cussed him out when he was leaving, and he's gonna face some other people. So he's gonna have some issues to resolve. But it seems anyway that David has pulled himself together, and with Joab's help, and now he's turning against Joab, and we'll also see how Joab deals with Amasa in the next chapter.
Yeah, I think there's probably two things going on here in closing. This is an obvious intentional revenge move from David on Joab. He's angry about the harsh words. He's probably angry that Joab's the one that killed Absalom, which he probably knows at this point. And so he is going to make him pay for that. And trying to make him pay for that by putting the guy that he just had to go into battle against in charge of his army. By the way, this makes no sense. You don't replace the guy, the winning general, with the losing general. This is like practically, this is not a good idea. Like, why would you do that? No. Like, you just, like, I'm going to give the guy who just lost the job of the guy who just won. That doesn't make any sense. Unless your motivation is revenge. I mean, that's a pretty big burn to do to a general. And then also to try to win over the people that Absalom have won over by, hey, here's a familiar person. This person has been convinced to come home. So, you know, you should follow suit. So there's, I think both of those things are going on. But there's no way that Joab likes this. And there's no reason he should like it.
Mm-mm. No, and as we'll see, and there's no way that Joab is going to sit back and let it happen.
Yeah, Joab's a very pragmatic guy.
Yes, yeah. Yes, he is. He knows how to deal with situations, and he will.
That's it. All right. Well, we are well out of time, so we'll pick up the rest of the story next week, Chad.
All right. See y'all then.